Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and my guest today, just to give you a teaser, is an extraordinarily courageous, honorable, and honest psychiatrist. You won't hear me say that very often, and I've gone far and wide to connect with him because he's in Australia. Jacques, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. My guest is Jacques McLaren, McLaren. Before telling you a little more about him, we're going to be discussing, among other things today, electroshock treatment. Now, my audience, certainly among the brightest, most alert, caring, critical people in the entire field of mental health, some of you know that the FDA, number of years ago, raised a question of should it finally evaluate electroshock machines. You'd think that over the many years since ECT's been around, which is 1938, certainly 1940, actively in the United States, the FDA would have gotten around to examining shock machines. They'll examine everything from toothpicks to new needle points. You'd think they'd take a look at something that batters the brain with 450 volts, causes a convulsion and a coma and flatlining, and always results in loss of, a concussive delirium and awakening with all kinds of shock-like symptoms of brain injury, disorientation, loss of memory, impaired judgment, and with each new shock treatment becomes more and more a case of flat-out head injury. You'd think, oh, and something that we have follow-up studies on, now even done by the advocates themselves, showing dementia long-term, that patients literally don't recover. Well, the FDA got around some number of years ago to, after listening to lots of input from thousands of people, 85 or 90% of which was negative, God, you've got to test these machines, decided that maybe they needed to test them for safety and effectiveness, and then got more and more lobbying from the shock machine manufacturers, but mainly from American Psychiatric Association and psychiatrists around the world. So now they have said they're planning and they want input on not having to test shock machines. In other words, one of the most devastating treatments in all of medicine, let alone psychiatry, more devastating than many forms of brain surgery, not going to be tested. And of course, there's a big hue and cry about that. Thank God for folks that have been writing to me, and I've been writing back and forth with them, and I've been giving them materials, and they've been using my huge site that I developed, thousands of hours of work in that site, I'm sure, called my resources, ectresources.org. People are using that, ectresources.org, to show the science of why this treatment should probably just be banned flat out and then maybe tested. Well, in Australia, there's also been a lot going on, and psychiatrist Jacques McLaren has been a leader, maybe the leader, he can tell us more about his role, in trying to stop involuntary shock, because we have involuntary shock treatment throughout the world probably, but certainly in the U.S. and certainly in Australia. So Jacques, with that pithy introduction, tell us more about yourself, I know you're in you're well. Let me fill it in a little bit. Jacques is in he's in Brisbane, Australia, I believe now. He's just been doing psychiatry for a long time, working in the sort of the outlands of Australia with hospitals and hospital staff. He's done forensic and military psychiatry, and you know, working with people with very severe disorders, very severe problems. And his book, which is a very interesting book that actually is quite innovative, The Biocognitive Model for Psychiatry. So now let me, after all that talk, hand the microphone way over to Australia to Jacques McLaren.
Thank you very much. So just remember there's a satellite lag when I'm talking to you. Yes, I've been in nearly 40 years since I graduated in psychiatry. And in that time, I've worked extensively in mostly in remote areas. So I was 6 years in the Kimberley Health Region, which is right in the north of Western Australia, and it's extremely remote. It was 2,500 kilometres from Perth, which is the capital of the state. And Western Australia is very big, by the way. And I was working in an area of about 400,000 square kilometres, and bear in mind that some of your states are only 7,500 square kilometres. And this was, a lot of it was semi-desert and working with the Aboriginal people, and there were no facilities whatsoever then. I was the entire resource, me and my, what you would call an SUV, and that was the limit of it. Then I went to Darwin, and I was mostly working in private practice there. But my private practice is what we call a bulk billing practice, which means I'm paid by the national insurer to see public patients. So anybody who would normally have to go to a public mental health service, I can see them as a private psychiatrist. I don't make as much money, but well, I don't make much money at all, but that's not the point. The point is to provide the service to people who otherwise couldn't get it. And I've been head of department of a 30-bed security psychiatric unit for 8 years. So my experience is very broad, very general. Very, very few people would have anything like the breadth and depth of experience that I've got. But I'm a bit peculiar in that I don't drink, so I've got to do something at night. If you live in the north of Australia, and you don't drink, you don't actually have a social life. So I study philosophy and like philosophy, which I think is very interesting. So my work is based mainly on the concept of whether we can actually correctly see mental disorder as a biological disease of the brain. You'll understand, of course, that the mainstream psychiatry throughout the world these days says that all mental disorder is a special case of brain disorder, and that's what's called physicalism. Now, my extensive work over decades shows that this is, in fact, impossible. It cannot be the case that mental disorder is brain disorder. It has to be seen as psychological. That therefore says that treatment must be psychological, and that the overwhelming emphasis these days on biological treatments of mental disorder is in fact wrong. In fact, it goes further, because we are now very, very well aware that the drugs used in psychiatry are very dangerous drugs. They are highly addictive. They have massive effects on the brains, unpredicted effects on the brains of people who take them long term. And we know that people who take psychiatric drugs in the long term will die on average 19 years younger than their brothers and sisters who don't take the drugs. So that's my position. And part of that, of course, is the notion that the question of whether we should in fact be using electroshock treatment. Now, in my 40 years, I've personally treated well over 10,000 cases. And bear in mind that when I work in private practice, it's solo. I have no support facilities whatsoever. I have no security, nothing. And in the private hospital, in the hospitals, I was in the position of being able to say, well, we will either use it or not use it. And in my 40 years, I've never used it. So I've directly treated well over 10,000 cases. And together with the cases I've supervised in hospital, that's about 15,000 consecutive, unselected public psychiatric patients have not been treated with ECT. I would think that that is actually the world's longest naturalistic study of ECT. And I didn't have to use it. And this, for orthodox psychiatry, this is outrageous. This is the ultimate heresy. And I've been treated very badly as a result of this, but I mean, that's just what you wear. And so that's led us to two major test cases, one in Melbourne in Victoria and one here in Brisbane. Am I talking too much? If you think I'm talking too much, just tell me.
This is going fine. You've given a nice background to who you are and basic thinking. When did you first speak out about shock treatment?
Well, it's a bit difficult to know because it only dawned on me when I was in Darwin, which is a very isolated city, that the public hospital where I was in charge, we were not using ECT, yet there was a psychiatrist in private practice who was giving ECT to about one-third of his patients. And I was a bit shocked by this, and I'd noticed that when I took over at the public hospital, the admission rate to hospital went down, the average duration of stay went down, so that the patients weren't in hospital as long, and the bed occupancy rate went right down, so we were actually able to close a ward. Now that was my undoing, because it meant that we didn't need as many nursing staff, and the nursing union didn't take that very well. But that's beside the point. What it meant was that by not using ECT, we were actually doing a better job. Now, you would think that the hospitals and the insurers would like this, but they don't seem to be very interested. Hospitals seem to like to have all of their beds full, because that means they can go to the government and get more money. And when I contacted Medicare, which is the national insurer, and I spoke to them about this, they said, well, look, doctor, that's terribly interesting, but we're only interested in over-servicing. We're not interested in under-servicing. We don't know what to do about that. So there's no interest. And I just recently sent a letter to the Australian New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, which likes to think of it as itself as a prestigious journal, pointing out that this is the case. I've treated 15,000 unselected consecutive public patients without using ECT, but they refused to publish the letter, which is more or less what I've expected. I've never been able to get time at a conference to raise this, and the psychiatric establishment is bitterly antagonistic to the idea that you can practice without ECT. The peculiar thing is, of all the hundreds of psychiatrists I've told this to, I have been able to talk at different conferences and different meetings and things, and of all the hundreds of psychiatrists I've told this to, not one of them has said to me, oh, how exciting, how interesting, can you teach us how to practice psychiatry without using ECT? All they do is shove their hands in their pockets and mumble something angrily and just stalk off. So there's something very fishy going on here in the state of psychiatry.
The anger is very interesting that you mentioned that. Back in the 1980s, I think it was 85, I was invited to be an expert on brain damage from ECT at our government's big ECT conference. And the original people who did the conference, I'm sure the National Institute of Mental Health didn't want me coming, but the overview body, the National Institutes of Health, said you've got to have Peter Breggin there to talk about the damaging effects of the treatment. You just can't have everybody putting on a positive show. We're supposed to have both sides here. And one of the things that was striking to me and to my wife, Ginger, and she'd only been living with me, we'd only been married a year or two at that point, was the shocking, not meaning to pun, the horrific amount of violence and hate that the shock doctors felt toward me. They really, really did. And I think some of that is that people who are particularly involved in shock, doing shock, are violent, hating human beings. I think it's in their character. Well, they wouldn't be shocking, as this one doctor you describe, a third of their patients. And they also are incompetent to help people otherwise. So it's one of my favorite phrases about all this is that it's not your mental condition that determines whether you get shock treatment. It's your doctor's moral condition as to whether you get shock treatment. But nonetheless, as you point out, even people who aren't necessarily doing a lot of shock treatment, they just don't want to face this issue. They don't want to go into conflict with their colleagues. They don't want to admit that the times they've given shock, it's an atrocity. But bless you for doing what you're doing, Jacques McLaren. It's quite amazing that you know, that's so alone, perhaps more alone than me in some ways. You've been doing this fight.
Well, yes. When I was in the Kimberley, I used to boast that I was the world's most isolated psychiatrist. But that's actually continued since I left, because now people will actually walk away. And what you said about the it's a luck of the draw whether you get ECT or not. We always say that people should give informed consent before they agree to take ECT. Now, strictly, this means that patients should be told that some psychiatrists use it a great deal, while some psychiatrists who see essentially the same types of patients under the same circumstances rarely or never use it. And so that the chances of whether you get ECT or not is entirely random. It's a question of who you are referred to. It's got nothing to do with the condition.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely true. And one of the things about informed consent that people don't talk about enough with regard to ECT is that once you've had one, two, or three treatments, it can happen right after your first one or maybe your second or your third, the person becomes so head injured that they're unable to even understand what's happening to them, and they're unable to resist the treatment. So I've seen many patients here in the U.S. who are getting shock treatment on an outpatient basis, which means somebody has to bring them in because they're incapable of bringing themselves to the outpatient ECT and incapable of bringing themselves back home, and they need supervision at home, and they never stop the treatment because they have had their willpower erased by what is essentially a closed head frontal lobotomy, traumatic electrical frontal lobotomy, that's rendered them apathetic and unable to protect themselves. So eventually, everybody's an involuntary patient for ECT, and things like this have led me to call for a ban on the treatment. Jacques, have you actually called for a ban yourself, or do you just want informed consent?
I haven't specifically stood up in public and said it should be banned. I have given evidence to different inquiries saying that it is not necessary, and this provokes intense hostility because the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists is the peak academic body here, similar to your APA without quite the commercial wing. Now, their position statement says that ECT remains a useful and essential treatment option that should be available to all patients in whom its use is clinically indicated. And I quote this to the inquiries, and I quoted it to a parliamentary inquiry just recently. And I said, firstly, it's only useful if you want to use it. If you don't need to use it, it is useless. And the second thing, essential. No, it is absolutely not essential. It is factually wrong of the College of Psychiatrists to say that ECT is essential. I have shown that it is not. So theirs is an opinion, mine are the facts. And the third thing here, it should be available to all patients in whom its use is clinically indicated. Well, that's up to the psychiatrist. If the psychiatrist says it's clinically indicated, then that's it. But we know, we all know, that they just talk to the patient for a few minutes and say, oh, yes, you need ECT. My initial assessment of every patient is very intense. It takes an hour, and quite often, even after 1 hour, I haven't reached the final decision about this person. So I know that the assessments they're using to decide that ECT is clinically indicated, they're just appalling. But to go back to that point you made about consent, I've got a patient at the moment who had ECT, he agreed to it, and then after 3 or 4, he didn't like it. He said, this is affecting my memory and I don't like it. I feel good for a short time, but then I crash. And so they just said, no, you've given consent, you just keep going. Then after 7, and when it came to 7, he said, no, I'm not having any more. So they then said, okay, you are unreasonably refusing treatment. We will therefore convert you into an involuntary patient and we will give it against your will. And this same person, later they gave him more ECT, and after he said, it's affecting my memory, I don't like it, no, so they made him an involuntary patient. And then after about 3 or 4, they went to him one day and said, oh, come and have your ECT, and found out that he'd had breakfast. And when they said, why have you had breakfast? He said, oh, I forgot I was having ECT. But these are the people who are telling him it doesn't affect his memory. It does affect memory. It does have permanent long-term effects. All of this talk about the safety of ECT is simply false. And there's a commentary by an anaesthetist here who had ECT some years ago, and he said, essentially, I had to go back to medical school. After I'd had ECT, I could not practice anaesthetics. And so that, you know, that's very damning because he agreed to it.
Yeah, I was just on the BBC last week. You can find it on my website. So 10-minute BBC interview. And the first 5 or 6 minutes are a doctor in Great Britain who was no longer able to practice after ECT, and she found the courage to go and talk on the air. And then they called me in because they couldn't find anybody brave enough, I guess, in Great Britain to speak up to comment on it, which I did. It makes a very convincing brief presentation of how bad things are. The cowardice of our colleagues about ECT is quite astonishing. Do you have any thoughts on that as to why? I mean, you're probably the first person physician in Australia to stand up on this issue. I'm the first and physician in the United States to stand up on this issue. What's the matter with all of our colleagues, in your view?
Right. Well, this is actually a very complex question that goes right to the heart of the issue. It's a question of the sociology of psychiatry. Now, the first one to remember, of course, is that they're making a lot of money out of it. So if you look at the private practitioners, they're making heaps of money for nothing, basically for nothing. So they can do up to 6 an hour at $150 each. That's $900 an hour for zero intellectual effort. You just walk in, say, hello, dear, how are you going? This won't take long. And then the patient is shocked, and you walk under the next one and say, hello, dear, how are you going? This won't take long. So there's really no intellectual effort in it. And it's money for jam. That's a pushover. And that goes back to, I think, Upton Sinclair, who said, I could never get a man to understand something if his job, if his income depended on him not understanding it. And that's very important. ECT here is a $200 million a year industry. I imagine in the US it's probably about $8 billion a year. So there's big, big money involved in this. And the second thing is, what about the psychiatrists in public practice who don't get paid per ECT, well, they're wedded to it. They are bound hand and foot to ECT, partly because it's a procedure, and everybody knows that we all doctors do procedures. And the second thing is that they are absolutely committed to the idea of biological psychiatry. They're so deep now, they cannot withdraw. They cannot now turn around and say, after 35 years of DSM, they cannot now turn around and say, hey, we goofed, we got it wrong. It's actually psychological. So there are very powerful pressures on them.
Well, and to add to that, I'm sure you'll agree, they don't know what else to do. And many of them, characterologically, by their personalities, are not exactly the most warm, caring, engaging human beings. They're not really able to help people. And in fact, when patients come to see them, they very likely make many of the people much worse off because of their authoritarian, controlling, cold approach, which makes people feel worse about themselves. So they see people just get worse. And if they give drugs, that tends to make people worse. And so they're locked in without knowing how and without actually being able to do anything else. It's really, really quite a dreadful circumstance. What sort of effect are you having, Jacques? You've been, again, we're talking with Jacques McLaren. His book, The Biocognitive Model for Psychiatry. I've invited Jacques here to the U.S. in the past and had him speak at one of our conferences. He's, as you can see, a very, very courageous, determined, ethical human being, and who's really taken on the psychiatry in his own country. And you've been very active in the courts recently. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, yes, this is very important. There have been two test cases, the first one in Victoria and the second one here in Queensland. Now, unfortunately, I can't talk about the case in Queensland because no person who goes before a mental health court is allowed to be publicised in any way whatsoever. What that means, of course, is the hospital can do what they like and nobody's allowed to expose it. No newspaper can publish anything relating to a person whose case has appeared before a mental health court. So the fact that that man's case appeared, that is the end of the matter. There can never be any publicity on that whatsoever. Isn't that just so cute? Now, Victoria...
even that person can't speak up? Jacques, let me interrupt. In the United States, of course, that person would be free to speak up and say anything they wanted, and it's not even true for the person?
He can speak up, but nobody can publish it.
Wow. That's
reality.
A difference in the free speech issues in our two countries.
Don't talk about free speech. In this country, truth is not a defense in a defamation action.
Oh, God. I can't believe that.
Yes. Oh, God. All right. But Victoria is a little bit different. We can talk about this case. And this, I think you probably are aware of it. It's a chap called Garth Daniels. He's a 39-year-old man. He has spent 14 of the last 20 years in mental hospitals. He has been seen by practically every psychiatrist in the state. His family think he's been seen by 400 psychiatrists and residents in that time. Now, he spent most of the last year in a hospital. He spent 69 days strapped to his bed, both hands and both feet, shackled to his bed, being injected by powerful antipsychotic drugs, which caused him akathisia. Now, you will be aware akathisia is a very, very unpleasant side effect where people become intensely agitated and irritable. Not only did he develop akathisia, but because he was strapped to his bed and couldn't move, they thought they'd better anticoagulate him so he didn't develop blood clots in his legs. But he didn't want any more tablets, so he'd spit them out, so they gave him one by injection. Now, this caused him a skin rash. Can you imagine the torture of being tied to a bed 24 hours a day, 69 days in a row, with this akathisia and a skin rash that you couldn't scratch? And they said that he was very aggressive. They couldn't let him up because every time the nurses went near him to give an injection, he'd spit at them. Well, what else is he going to do? Because they weren't taking any notice of him. So, you know, the torture of that is unimaginable. But the hospital, you could not get them to see that, you know, letting him go might be the only option. Anyway, they decided that the only thing they could do to this man was to give him ECT. Now, he refused. He'd signed a statement before, long before, saying he never wanted to have ECT. And his family had power of attorney, and they said they didn't want him to have ECT, but the hospital managed to override it. And I went down and interviewed this man at considerable length, and I went through 15,000 pages of totally disorganized and chaotic and shoddy case notes. And my decision was that this man was not dangerous. Now, you need to understand that I've worked in very dangerous places. I've worked in prisons. I work with veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I know danger. I've worked with Aboriginal people who don't speak English out in the desert. And I know what dangerous means. And in fact, I deal with people in my private practice whom I consider too dangerous to send to a hospital. I've got two veterans at the moment who have said, if anybody tries to put me in a mental hospital, there will be bodies everywhere. And I don't doubt that these men are telling the truth. So believe me, I know danger. And Garth Daniels is not dangerous. He's a very mild-mannered chap. He's very bright. He's got a good sense of humour, an impish sense of humour. And he is not dangerous. In 20 years, including 14 years in mental hospitals, he's been in two fights. One, he bolted his father, who freely admits he provoked it. And the other one, he headbutted a nurse who was trying to give him an injection after he'd said, I don't want it. Now, that's all. He's actually himself been attacked four or five times in mental hospitals and had fractures to show for it. So the hospital said, we have no option. We must strap this man to the bed and we must shock him. And when I went down, I put a case to the mental health services that, in fact, this was not danger. What had happened, there were psychological reasons, and that this was actually a case that should be understood psychologically. And when I put that case to the tribunal, the mental health services said, we're not going to approve ECT. This was Thursday last week. So Monday last week, this man was so dangerous that he was strapped to his bed. Monday coming, the family will go to the hospital to discuss his discharge. Once they realised they couldn't give him ECT, they've now said they're going to discharge him from hospital. Now, you must ask yourself, who's mad in this? It's completely, completely insane.
Well, what has happened since then? This sounds like a victory.
It's a victory. It's a substantial victory. The hospital's admitted defeat. They've also been forced to acknowledge that they were not using the least restrictive form of treatment. So they're in serious trouble. What comes of this, I don't know. I think all the family want to do is just get away. But, of course, they haven't been able to because he's been held in hospital on this order. But anyway,
congratulations. This is I've been trying to follow the Garth Daniels case, and it's been a little difficult to figure out just what happened. And so what happened is you intervened, you wrote a report, and who did you write the report to?
It goes to the Mental Health Tribunal, but it was I put a generic case against ECT, and this is important. This is very important. And that was similar to the case I used here in Brisbane yesterday, which didn't quite succeed, but there were other reasons. So the important point is that out of this has come a generic case against ECT, what I would perhaps call a universal case. And it shows that, in fact, the hospital has set it up as a matter of logic that this man is in such a state that they have to use ECT. And the critical thing is that they believe in the biology of mental disorder, and that once they've believed that, they cannot back down. And this is important. I had other cases, one case where a person presented to hospital at the age of 16 with a classic psychologically determined depressive condition. The original case notes were actually quite good because he went to the Child and Youth Service, and they tend to take more detailed psychological assessments rather than these strict biological assessments that you get in adult psychiatry. So there we have, from many years ago, a clear-cut case of a psychologically determined depressive state. Unfortunately, he ended up in the adult service because he got into trouble with the police. And he was then put on drugs, and it's just gone from bad to worse. And all along, he said, I don't like the drugs, they're making me worse, they cause me side effects, etc., etc. So they then gave him ECT some years ago, and he said, it's no good, it's making me worse. And it clearly says, you know, he's discharged after having had a course of ECT, and it writes in the case notes, improved. 2 weeks later, he's back in hospital in exactly the same state. And to say that that is an improvement is just a travesty. So the important thing out of this has come, and this is what I need to do, is to be talking this over with a lot of people around the world, is that it looks as though there is, in fact, a generic case, a logical case, against ECT. And that's the good news, I think, that's come out of this. Because if it is the case, it means that orthodox psychiatry is in serious trouble.
Yeah, and of course, I've been trying to make that case. I wrote a whole book about the case against ECT in 1979, and have done many articles and book chapters since then. I'm so glad to have you working on the same basic principle. There is a generic case, similar to the generic case I made against lobotomy in the early 70s, Jacques, which was actually quite successful in slowing it. Slowing down lobotomy around the world. A generic case means the treatment shouldn't exist, that this is wrong in principle, it's wrong in science, it's wrong morally. So just again looking at this and congratulating you, so you convinced with your generic case the tribunal to not force this man to have ECT, and then within a week the hospital discharges him. Did they give any reason for him going from a patient who had to have shock treatment and be tied down to sending him home?
I have no idea. This has actually been their pattern all along. Last year in, I think, April, he was in hospital, tied to his bed, being injected in the morning. And in the afternoon, the parents got a phone call saying, oh, we're just going to put him in a taxi and send him home. And then, of course, he went into a withdrawal state. Now, this raises another critical issue, which you've covered extensively, but that one is a major uphill battle. The concept that psychiatric drugs are addictive in every sense of the word. And when you stop them, people go into a severe withdrawal state. And that is not only feels terrible, but it's absolutely terrifying to them. But psychiatry's response always is to give them more drugs. It's like giving a drunk, when a drunk goes into the DTs, you just start, hey, have a bottle of scotch, that'll make you feel better. So this is a critically important issue. Now, this one is not a question of logic, this is a question of empirical science. Are psychiatric drugs addictive? Do they cause withdrawal states? Well, I'm absolutely convinced they do, because patients tell me they do over and over and over again.
Yes, absolutely. There's just no doubt about it. Just today, in my practice, I'm working with a young man who was 10 years from age 13, 10 years on antidepressant, and he's off. But of course, it's not easy for anybody to go through that. It's just horrific for folks to go through that. Jacques, when did you start to doubt your profession?
I can give you a bit of background, because I graduated in medicine in 1970 in Perth, and Perth is quite a conservative city. It's the most isolated capital city in the world, but it's actually unusual because it's very open, and you know, when you live in Perth, you regard Asia as your backyard, whereas the eastern states of Australia, we regard them as foreigners, and we would really like to cut them adrift and let them drift away. We don't actually like them. So Perth is very open, and my original intention was to be a country general practitioner. So I'm from a small country town originally, and that was always my dream doing medicine. I will be a country practitioner. But my first job, when I was in my intern year, they put me straight into neurosurgery. And it was fascinating. I loved it. I was so excited by this. And so a while later, I went back and did another 3 months in neurosurgery, and I was won over. This is what I wanted to do. So I started the training. I started training in neurosurgery. And then later, sometime down the track, I had a spare 3 months in I had an elective. And I had two choices. I could either go back to the emergency department, the casualty department, where I'd spend an awful lot of time, or I could go and do psychiatry. I thought, well, psychiatry, that would be very interesting for a person, for a neurosurgeon. So I said, I'll do the psychiatry term. And within 24 hours, I had the feeling, this is what I really needed. This is what I really wanted. So I completed the 3 months, then I went back to surgery, and I had to go back into general surgery. And at the end of the second day, we'd done a couple of gallbladders, and we'd done, you know, a few other things and a couple of sets of hemorrhoids, and I walked out of the operating theatre, and I got onto the phone to the professor of psychiatry and said, can you give me a job? I've got to do it. I can't do surgery for the rest of my life. And so that was it. 3 months later, I started psychiatry. Now, the interesting thing was I went straight into this intensely biological unit where they were all trained at the Maudsley Hospital in London. You probably know about that. And it occurred to me, coming from neurosurgery, that what they were saying about the brain was not true. They were making all sorts of claims about the brain, about neurophysiology, all of this sort of stuff, and I'm sitting there thinking, this professor is talking, are you allowed to say shit on the phone? Well, I just did.
Well, I don't know, but it can be edited out. Go ahead.
This professor is not talking science. He is not talking neuroscience. He is talking ideology. I didn't know it was ideology at that time. And so it went downhill from there. And then, but I thought, well, that's okay. I was very interested in it. I did a lot of biological study, but my real interest was to be a psychotherapist. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what I was interested in. And when we then did a series of lectures in psychoanalysis, Freudian psychoanalysis, and then I went to the library and I got out the copy of Otto Fenichel's Psychoanalytic Theory of Neurosis from, I think, 1948, which was considered the Bible, and I started to read it and very quickly realized these people are saying things which are unjustified. You cannot say that. You cannot claim to know what a neonatal baby believes or thinks or feels. And it went downhill. So very quickly I'd arrived at an intensely skeptical position. And I didn't know that is actually a philosophical position. And it was only after I'd graduated in psychiatry, by the skin of my teeth, I should point out, they threatened to sack me quite a number of times. But, you know, you can't sack your best student. So I passed the exams, in record time, and I don't mind saying with flying colors. And then they wouldn't give me a job. So that was okay. I went and worked in the prisons, which was good fun. I like work, you know, I like working with that sort of, you know, I like working with people who have had a rough time, rough life. And so then I drifted into a period of analyzing what we're actually doing, and then realized after some time, I'm reading philosophy books. I'm reading basic philosophy of mind, basic logic. And then I discovered the philosophy of science, people like Karl Popper, Thomas Kuhn, Imre Lakatos, Paul Feyerabend, people like that. And so then I enrolled in philosophy in order to do a PhD, which unfortunately I never finished because I went bush and you couldn't do an external PhD. But in no time I was studying and reading philosophy. And that was shocking. At 35 years of age, I went back to university. They let me in at second year level based on some of my work. But there I was sitting in a class with 18-year-olds, and the shocking thing, I thought, I am the head of Department of Psychiatry at the Veterans Affairs Hospital, and these kids can think better than I can. I don't know how to think. And that was very shocking. It was good fun. And they're great kids. I loved them. It was really good. It was a very exciting time. But the further I went into philosophy, the further I went away from psychiatry, and it eventually reached the point where I couldn't talk to them because we're talking different languages. And now, since then, I've had to try and come back, and now I know how to talk to them, but, of course, they don't want to hear what I'm saying. So it's a long pilgrimage, you could say. And really, I could say that when I was in the Kimberley region in Western Australia, which is wilderness, you know, it's a designated wilderness area, World Heritage Wilderness Area, and writing philosophical works which were considered heretical by mainstream psychiatry, then I thought, hey, I'm the voice in the wilderness.
You have really been a voice in the wilderness. Let me shift totally to another subject that I personally want to hear you talk about. You've been working with the original Australian people, the so-called indigenous people. I would just love your observation on these human beings, anything you might want to say comparatively to the cultures that are different cultures, but also anything you might say about the lessons of human nature, a basis. Have you concluded, as I have, that there's just a basic human nature that we all share, whether we're an indigenous people that, you know, whose civilization goes back tens of thousands of years, or whether we're so-called moderns? I'd just love your comments on that. Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine. Now, remember that the Aboriginal people of Australia they've been here 50,000 years, and in that time they were cut off until the first white contact, which was only just over 200 years ago. So Australia was colonized by the British in 1788, which was after your War of Independence. So that's how recent it is. And the British took one look at the Aboriginal people, and there's a very famous comment by a chap called William Dampier in about 1680, and he said they are the most miserablest people I have ever seen. And the British really didn't regard them as human beings. They really weren't quite sure that these were human beings or just killer monkeys, because they didn't speak any language that anybody could understand. A very, very totally different language. 50,000 years their languages have existed alone without outside input. So they had no structure, they had no written language, they had no buildings, they had no social structure, no kings, no chiefs, no anything that you could identify. And so the British weren't really sure that they were people, and they declared this terra nullius, that it means unoccupied land, which meant that they could come in and just shoot anybody who got in their way. But in fact, most of the Aboriginal people were devastated by diseases. They had absolutely no resistance to the Western diseases, particularly viral diseases. So around Sydney, they were essentially wiped out by smallpox. and in the more remote areas, they were wiped out by measles, chickenpox, and whooping cough. And their state of health has never recovered. Now, their traditional life, because they weren't used to machines, it's not like they're taking African people to the US and say they didn't have a tradition of agriculture. And the men don't like digging in the dirt. That's women's work. So it was only in the north where the men worked on the big cattle stations, what you would call a cattle ranch, that they became economically valuable people, because they weren't economically valuable down south. So they were pushed out of their traditional lands, but they were dying under the influence of the diseases and, of course, alcohol as well. And there was some violence, but that was actually quite a small part of it. There were no great wars like you had your Plains Wars against the North American Aboriginal people, the Indian people. We didn't have that. To work with Aboriginal people, you have to remember that everything you've learned in psychiatry just doesn't apply. Everything they've taught you doesn't apply. Just forget it. Start again. And then and only then can you start to make contact with them. If you try and look at them through the lens of the Western biological psychiatry trained person, then you might just stay in the cities, don't go bush. And what you realize very quickly is that they're human beings. They are essentially the same as us. They're just a bit more sunburned. They have everything that we regard as fundamental to us, they've got too. Everything that we would regard as strange, they regard that as strange. So there is a basic human nature, but it is also the same as the higher primates. So there's actually a higher primate nature. We are territorial, social, hierarchical. We form dominance hierarchies. We are quite aggressive. We're using aggression instrumentally. That's human nature, qua higher primate nature. Then the rest of it, we've got a sense of humour, well, so do Aboriginal people. They've got a very clever, very subtle sense of humour. It's not violent. And there was one thing I noticed when I got back to Australia after working in Asia, that Australian sense of humour is very, very aggressive. If you listen to Australian comics, they are incredibly aggressive. And it's all based on violence. I don't like it. Whereas their sense of humour is based on people making themselves look silly or people looking silly. So they would laugh at white people for their pretentiousness. But you would never know what they were laughing at. And people say, oh, they're just children. In fact, they're not. They're laughing at a very, very subtle perception of human stupidity as whites exemplify it. And boy, do we exemplify human stupidity. And that was really their only defense against whites, to be able to laugh at us, because they couldn't be aggressive, because we've got these very powerful police forces. They can't run away because they're tied to their land because it's totemic. They can't beat us aggressively in any way, except on the sport field. And then they're good. Then they come into their own. So what do we know about Aboriginal people? Well, they're people just like us. They are no different in our fundamental respects. We're kidding ourselves if we think we are superior. We're not. We're different, but in many respects we are. The aggressive Western white people are very, very much their inferior. They're much, much more subtle. I'm not going to say that everything about the community, the civilization was good. It's not. It was a very rigidly patriarchal society. Women were regarded as chattels. They didn't have the rights that men give themselves. So, you know, it's not perfect by any means, but nor is ours.
Do you think that human nature, as I do, I've written about it in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, I think that we have these fundamental violent reactions that in all cultures we have to find ways to control. Your thoughts on that.
Humans are aggressive, and I've talked about this quite a lot because aggression, you know, with my background in military psychiatry and prisons and that, and aggression is interests me greatly and it scares me because it'll be our undoing. But I think we can make a strong case for there being a very, very high level of innate aggression in humans, and we are kidding ourselves when we pretend it's not. When we say we're not aggressive, we're simply channeling it into other ways. And you can look at the global financial crisis as an example of channeled aggression. We were crushing the poor people, and then the whole thing unraveled. Then instead of punishing the people who did wrong, the wealthy, the plutocrats, the financiers, we penalized the poor people by borrowing against taxpayers, future taxpayers, and bailing out the criminals.
Wow. Well, you know, I do think it's so important to acknowledge the inherent aggressivity, or we just don't understand what's going on in the world around us. And there is a great deal of more utopian thinking that wants to say that if we just got environment right, people wouldn't be aggressive. I just don't think that's so. Worse environments make people worse, but simple opportunity is enough for many human beings to get aggressive. I'm really glad to...
We're territorial
and possessive.
And we're hierarchical, and we need to be on top. Men, male creatures, do not feel good unless they're on top. And that, because if you're not on top, it is inhibitory of your sexual function. We know that. So male testosterone levels drop if you go down the social scale. That's why men want to get on top, and once they're on top, they will stop at nothing to stay there. So there's a very, very powerful biological reason driving human aggression, and it is extremely dangerous to pretend otherwise.
Jacques McLaren, we're coming near to an end, McLaren. Jacques, what's the best way for people to... follow your work, or even to get in touch with you if you would like to make that available?
They can always find me on Google. I do have a website, but I'm very bad at keeping it up to date. I do get a lot of emails from around the world, and it's very difficult. I can't answer any individual questions. I can only talk to people about the general academic thrust. If they need personal assistance, they're probably better off talking to somebody or joining something like Mind Freedom International.
We got to go now. You sound a lot like me. Jacques McLaren, thank you so much for being on with us from Australia. Thank you.
That's my pleasure, Peter. See you later.